This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
In June of 2012, Nation Institute senior fellow Chris Hedges and comics journalist Joe Sacco were in the KBOO studios live on the air to talk about their book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. After half an hour, Chris and Joe ran out of time, but not out of stories. So they agreed to stick around and chat some more with host S.W. Conser about their adventures together, reporting from trouble spots both at home and abroad. So without further ado, here's part two of the Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco conversation from June 25th, 2012.
Well, we are back with a special web-only edition of Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm delighted to continue our chat today with the authors of the new book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Joe Sacco is a celebrated comics journalist and Guggenheim Fellow. Chris Hedges is a longtime foreign correspondent and senior fellow at the Nation Institute. And I wanted to talk some more about Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. There are five chapters, each originating from a different part of the country: the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, the streets of Camden, New Jersey, the coal fields of West Virginia, the tomato fields of Florida, and finally the Occupy Wall Street encampment in New York. And do you ever, you know, I have to wonder. One of the things that struck me in the book, Chris, how do you respond to critics who say that you've lost your objectivity, that you might be sermonizing more than reporting these days?
Well, I care a lot more about truth than I do about news, and they're not the same thing. And I think that the great reporters, like the great preachers, care primarily about truth, which is why those reporters are management problems in the newsroom. They will hammer against centers of power that are close to those people who run the newspaper.
Did you ever worry that in this day of narrowcasting, you might be preaching to the choir, that the people who really need to read your books are instead tuned into Fox News and buying up the latest title by Glenn Beck or Ann Coulter?
No, because I think most people who watch Fox News probably don't read books anyway, unless it's the Left Behind series. My problem is with the liberal class.
How do you mean the liberal class?
The traditional liberal establishment that I think has fallen for the political theater and the what Benjamin DeMott calls the junk politics, and invested their hopes in it, as they did with Obama. Who I did not support. I voted, not only voted for Nader, I wrote all of his major policy speeches for him.
Oh, really?
In 2008, yeah. And I think that we don't understand how power works. We should all go out, if you haven't, and read Sheldon Wolin's Democracy Incorporated, which is about, our system of what he calls inverted totalitarianism. And we can't effectively fight power if we don't understand the configurations of power. So I'm really writing for the liberal class. I'm writing for that class that has surrendered its hopes and invested its energy in a dead political system.
Was it Utah Phillips who said that a strong sense of history is the most radical thing you can have? I keep thinking that the two of you must be fans of the early 20th century muckraking books like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and Ida Tarbell's History of the Standard Oil Company, How the Other Half Lives by Jacob Rees.
Well, that's what this book is. I think. I mean, it's really out of that tradition where we don't think that there's anything wrong with moral outrage. That, by the way, is never in a pass not to tell the truth. And there's many portraits of people in this book that are not particularly flattering, whether it's interviews with prostitutes or drug addicts or people who carry out egregious acts of violence against the innocent within these areas. We're not interested in romanticizing or lying about the poor. But at the same time, we have a very strong, throughout the narrative, and palpable sense that what has been done to these people is an egregious injustice.
Now, you're working for The Nation now, Chris, but back in 2002, you shared a Pulitzer Prize with a team of reporters at the New York Times talking about liberal institutions for a series of stories on terrorism. And, you know, I can't help thinking there are a lot of foreign correspondents out there who pretty quickly grow cold and calloused from all their encounters with war and inhumanity. With you, the opposite effect seems to have happened. The more atrocities you've seen, the more outspoken and indignant your voice has become.
Yeah, I don't think I think that is maybe a stereotype. There's a people who cover war tend to be a small fraternity that leap from conflict to conflict. So when I was covering the war in Kosovo, in Bosnia and in Kosovo, I was working with people, reporters and photographers that I'd worked with 20 years before in the war in El Salvador. And, you know, like an emergency room doctor or, you know, like someone in the military, you learn to cope, you build a kind of outer shell to cope with, you know, horrific human suffering and atrocity. But I think it's not correct to say that it doesn't affect you.
Mm-hmm.
The problem comes more from the trauma, the exposure to trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, which makes it extremely difficult, you know, when you attempt to cope with this, to connect with people. There's a kind of numbing capacity to PTSD. But you know, even at that moment, I would say that, you know, because that, you know, you can't feel, it doesn't mean you don't care. I think most of those reporters and photographers, you know, care far more than appears, you know, from the outside.
Well, this is interesting to me. I don't know that this gets out much, but you're a graduate of the Harvard School of Divinity, and you've written extensively about the corruption of the gospel message by powerful religious leaders. Most recently, you very publicly called out the rector of New York City's Trinity Church for his evicting and arresting members of the Occupy movement.
Yes. I mean, there's a classic example of a church masquerading as a corporation. It has $1 billion in real estate assets in southern Manhattan. It is one of its tenants is Goldman Sachs. The rector
really?
Cooper, yeah, earns a salary of $1.2 or $1.3 million a year, lives in a $5.5 million townhouse in New York. It's just, if you want, in terms of theological terms, these people are the Antichrist. And they have a vacant lot down adjacent to Duarte Square, off of Canal Street, that after everyone was pushed out of Zuccotti Park, we attempted to occupy. And the first person over the fence was my good friend Bishop George Packard, an Episcopal bishop, also a highly decorated Vietnam War vet, came back after the war and went to seminary and had to cope with the killing that he had been involved with, including, as he talks about, the shooting of the wounded so they wouldn't make noise after an ambush. And then they were all arrested. Trinity had them arrested. Trinity had them charged. Trinity would not drop the charges. I went to the trial. I sat in with George and everyone else being prosecuted, and most of them were given community service, although one activist was sentenced to 45 days in jail. So, this sort of hypocrisy and hiding behind the institution of the church to support the interests of the 1% is deeply distasteful to me, and we carried out an action in Zuccotti Park in New York right before everybody went to trial on June 11th with Father Daniel Berrigan, 92 years old, came down, one of my great heroes, came down and spoke at the park.
Did you, back in seminary, did you read Here I Stand by Martin Luther? I just can't help flashing back to when Martin Luther would get annoyed because the Vatican was skewing the gospel message, was taking the radicalism out. He would call them antichrist and heretics. And you have actually referred to the corporate and political institutions who hide behind the Christian label as heretics. You're not shy about
right.
calling on your own seminary training.
That's the problem of the liberal church, is that they have not called out the Christian right for what it is, which is an heretical movement.
And this is something in the death of the liberal class that you
yeah,
and also American fascists that you get worked up about.
American fascists, yeah, mostly. And it's, although I do write about it in Death of the Liberal Class, but this is the great failing of the liberal church. You know, you allow these buffoonish figures like Joel Osteen or Pat Robertson to utterly distort and corrupt, upend the core message of the Christian gospel. And use it
as... Pat Robertson, the diamond miner?
Yeah, there you go. I mean, the guy is worth anywhere between $500,000 and $1 billion,
personally. Isn't that what Operation Blessing is pretty much diamond mining operation?
Yes, it is. And
okay.
And it's, you know, blood diamonds. And, I mean, it's just staggering what these people do. And they prey on people's despair. They manipulate these people for money and wealth, essentially, holding out the idea that prayer and belief in God will make you wealthy and give you material resources you don't have. And the church, which should know better, and all these people like myself who graduated from seminary, get out into the wider world and say nothing. I mean, what do they think? The radical Christian message of the Christian gospel doesn't have to be fought for. It's absolutely staggering, and I think one of the reasons why the liberal church has lost its moral authority.
How is it that the current chair of the House Budget Committee, Paul Ryan, who's made the works of Ayn Rand required reading for his staff, goes around claiming that Christianity is the real inspiration for his giveaways to the rich, and no major media outlet will call him on it?
Well, because, you know, essentially major media outlets serve the same center of power that Ryan serves, which is corporate America. And, you know, this is the whole problem, that perversion of the gospel has essentially become legitimized. And actually, I mean, if you say the word Christian, most people don't think of William Sloan Coffin or, you know, Daniel Berrigan or perhaps even Martin Luther King. They probably think of these Looney Tunes on the Christian right.
And you've made the point that the major media outlets here in the U.S. have abrogated their duty to research the facts and lay them out for the public. So instead of shooting down the spin and distortion of our political and business leaders, they just play the role of stenographers and then tell us, okay, the readers, the citizens, okay, you're on your own. You make your own decision about what's a fact and what's a lie.
Yeah, it's very cynical, and they make a lot of money in the process, so that you have these, whether it's on MSNBC or Fox or anywhere else, I don't care, they are celebrities, they're pulling down, you know, a million plus a year, you know, it's all about, you know, they may know that both sides are lying. But as long as you give them both 7 minutes, you've done your job.
Well, here's a simple fact, for example. The Republican House is in charge of the federal budget, which determines the number of workers in the public sector. And for the past year and a half, it's them, it's the Republican House that have been actually killing those jobs, even while private sector employment slowly rises. So they're the responsible party for the same economy that they're complaining about. And again,
well,
you know,
of course.
You don't,
I mean, you know, that is part of the frustration that I think those of us who care about truth carry, in that they have managed to essentially distort the message, distort the truth, distort you know, what centers of power are doing, and you know, that's why the public relations industry is an evil industry.
You're listening to a special archived episode of Words and Pictures from June 25th, 2012, featuring a conversation with best-selling author and foreign correspondent Chris Hedges and comics journalist Joe Sacco. Here again is host S.W. Konser.
Now, speaking of, public relations and journalism, it's hard to know where one begins and one ends these days. But Joe, your book, War's End, features a biting story about the Foreign Press Corps during the Bosnian War. The story is called Christmas with Karadzic, which is a reference to Radovan Karadzic, the former Bosnian Serb leader and war criminal. There were some really bizarre twists to the story that you wrote. To me, it was like some absurdist play that Bertolt Brecht or Vaclav Havel might have written.
Well, it certainly had that. It certainly had that component. I mean, we were traveling around. I was traveling with these two radio guys. And, you know, the way radio works, as you probably know, but anyway, how it works.
I know a thing or two.
Yeah. All right. How it works in the field is you get paid by your story. You get paid by the piece if you're a freelancer. So the idea was to do as many pieces as possible in the course of a day.
So break up a story into component parts.
Yes, and I remember one more seasoned radio correspondent turning to a younger one and saying, God, you just filed that story? That story was five stories. He just broke down the parts of it and said each of these could have been, you know, a $50, $100, whatever they got for pieces. I mean, you see that sort of the way money plays a role in even how journalism comes to us.
And here you are doing a 300 or 400 page graphic, you know, memoir of yeah. I mean, that's a completely different.
It's a different sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be pretty invested as a cartoonist. I mean, it just takes such a long time to draw,
right,
and to do a book that you have to be very invested in the topic itself. It has to matter to you to want to keep doing it 5-6 years down the road after you've done the reporting.
So you turned out, were one of the only people kind of interested in finding out where Karadzic was. You know, here was this figure who was causing so much consternation on the world stage, and he was just walking around free as
a bird.
Well,
I mean, what journalists do is the idea, it makes perfect sense. This guy's a war criminal. Supposedly, he should be arrested by any international force that can do it. And we wanted to see if we could go and find him, and we could. I mean, there was no serious attempt to arrest him at that point.
You didn't have much. It was almost like he was in the phone book.
Well, you basically go around and you ask people where he's going to be. I mean, Chris and I had this experience in Gaza. We wanted to see a Hamas senior official named Rantisi, and you have a general idea where he is, and then you just start asking people in the street, and kids are always going to say something to you. I mean, kids aren't thinking in terms of security in that way, and you just go and you ring the bell, and you go upstairs, and you meet the guy.
So it's Christmas time, and you hooked up with Radovan Karadzic.
In that particular story that took place in Bosnia.
And you ended up, you know, not hating him in person.
Well, I mean, it's just coming, you know, maybe it's that whole idea of the banality of evil. I mean, here he is in this, he's wearing a suit, he's standing in a service, and he's bowing his head, and you understand.
This is a Christmas mass.
A Christmas mass, Orthodox Christmas mass, and I mean, cerebrally, you know what this man is responsible for.
But if he wasn't charming, he wouldn't have gotten into power.
That's true. But I mean, I want to talk about that feeling of being in the presence of someone like that, and perhaps not being able to muster up that sort of absolute anger at this physical individual. It's more easy to make him an abstract idea and be angry at that.
There's something about cartooning. I've seen some of Crumb's, some of Robert Crumb's cartoons where he's depicted people who are, you know, part of the establishment, part of the corporate herd, and with him, they're always schlubs. You know, they're always pathetic. They don't have horns and pitchforks. So it's kind of interesting. Here's this sad individual, you know, on some level.
Well, I mean, he's responsible for so much. I don't know if I'd call him a sad individual, but you know, he's one of us. I mean, actually, when you think about it, he's a human being. And
so
what
it's
you
like
realize,
looking into a mirror there, on some level.
Well, we have capabilities. Is the human species has certain capabilities. Some of us go in certain directions and some of us don't. I mean, depending on what stuff we're born with to some extent and also the environment or whatever.
But also small steps, you know,
there are small steps that can lead someone into this. I mean, who's the German woman who died recently? She wrote the
Gita
book.
Sereni.
Yeah, she wrote the book Into That Darkness.
It's a brilliant book.
It's a brilliant book. But and she writes about the Commandant of Treblinka. And this guy's responsible for about 900,000 deaths. But you see him as a person. You see how, like you say, small steps got him there. It's not like he woke up one day and said, I want to be responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. But the system moves people like that who aren't willing to sort of put their foot down and say, no, I'm not going to be part of this. It sort of slowly moves them into a position like that.
Well, it's when a distorted system, such as a totalitarian system, preys on careerists. Careerists are everywhere. And
most of us are careerists.
Yeah,
I mean.
And so, you know, the fact is you seek to advance, as Stengel did within the SS, and he did what was required of him to advance, and that just happened to be happened to include the murder of innocents, including children.
Well, closer to home, on a less spectacular level, corporate leaders will tell you that when it comes to people versus profits, their hands are tied. Yeah, much as they'd all love to promote sustainability and human dignity over short-term profits, they say they have a responsibility to their investors. And our courts have stated outright that the primary role for publicly traded companies is to create maximum returns for their shareholders. And a company could be sued if they take any high-minded actions that get in the way of profits.
Well, they're not going to take any high-minded actions. They don't give a damn. The, you know, commodities index of Goldman Sachs is one of the largest in the world. It buys up futures of corn, rice, wheat, wheat's increased in price by 100%, and it means children in Africa starve, and that's how they make their money. You know, the callousness of it, the by the time you sort of reach the upper levels of management within these corporations, most of the qualities that are most pronounced are those that are embraced by psychopaths.
You know, Chris, something in a recent column of yours kind of surprised me. It said you were an amateur boxer in your younger days.
I was actually paid. I was a semi-pro.
Oh, really? Semi-pro boxer?
$25 a fight.
And nowadays, you're so averse to violence, you're even suspicious of the liberation theology movements.
Well, I've always been critical of liberation theology. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with boxing,
because the people in the ring have agreed.
You choose to get into a ring. Okay. I mean, you're not hitting somebody who doesn't want to get into a ring. My problem with boxing was more that when someone was dazed as a boxer, and I'm talking about when you're fighting someone else, you wanted the fight to stop. I mean, then boxing, we're not there to just like take somebody who's staggering around the ring and keep hitting them. That's just disgusting. And there was a deep disdain on the part of, I was part of a boxing team, of the boxers for the crowd, because the crowd never appreciated generally the effort and the skill that went into boxing. They just wanted to see somebody clobbered, which always made, those of us who were at ringside quite angry. The other problem I have with boxing is that it messes up your head. I mean, I'd come back from fights and I couldn't focus for like 6 hours, and you're nauseous, and because you're bashing your brain into your skull and bruising it. So, I was in the greatest shape. I did college sports and high school sports, but I was certainly in the greatest shape of my life the 2.5 years that I boxed. When you're fighting another skilled boxer who can protect himself, then I think it's a great sport.
And can I just say that I was on the fencing team in high school?
Joe,
were on the recycling. Didn't you do that? I think you should.
I was on the recycling team.
And what was it? The Saturday morning.
The Earth People.
Well, Joe, I was starting to giggle because you had a lot of experience with headbangers, both here in Portland and in
my
Bosnia.
Rock days.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, but also, yeah, when the people who had been through all of this horrible conflict during the Bosnian War, let loose at clubs, there's a lot of headbanging and ear-splitting music. And
well, what interests me, just on a human level, is what things people hang on to, even under extreme times like being under siege, when malnutrition is a problem and when shelling could happen at any time. I mean, you meet people who are hanging on to something about their humanity. And I appreciated the fact that people were still interested in that sort of culture that they've created or they enjoy. I mean, they wanted that. It gave them some of their humanity. Mm-hmm. There. I mean, they weren't all just, say, they weren't like victims with this capital V. They were striving for something else. They were hungry for news about films and things like that. I'm always interested in that sort of thing.
Did you sometimes wish for kind of more of that intensity, more of that vitality in the communities in the U.S. that you visited and saw dying?
I've got to say, I mean, I saw a lot of deadening of people. I mean, except for those individuals who seem to really strive somehow to get out of it or to dig their heels in against what was happening to them, I felt like people had deadened themselves. And I think part of that, I felt also that a lot of people were self-medicating around the country.
In the chapter of Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, the chapter opens on this town that is essentially
White Clay, Nebraska,
a bunch of liquor stores on a corner where people go to deaden themselves.
Yeah, because you can't buy alcohol on the reservations, so people just drive the 3 or 4 or 5 miles, whatever it is, across the border. It's right on the border. And there you can get what you want, and you just sit in the street and drink until you just make your life into a haze. That's how difficult it is.
And there was
sort of like cartoonists.
Sniffing ink is what we do.
There was an uprising on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and that got put down very strongly, which, so the idea of that happening again seems remote. I mean, back in the 70s, the Wounded Knee uprising.
Who can say? I mean, the interesting things about uprisings or acts like that is I mean, they come from, I think they come from this force that people need to do something. They do something, and then they haven't really figured out what it is they're doing.
Yeah.
And it can get directed maybe in ways that might not be helpful or whatever, but well, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say, Joe, that you take incredible care with your artwork, and you've been known to collect pages of rough sketches and photo reference and other documents in order to draw even a single panel, certainly in the case of Footnotes in Gaza. But sometimes you let loose with the exaggeration, and you've been quoted as saying that your more cartoony images lead to a greater truth than straight-ahead representation.
Well, what are you looking for? I mean, if you're going to draw the energy in a club in Sarajevo, if you had a literal, sort of a very representational drawing of people sitting around headbanging, it wouldn't give you the energy of that moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it's almost like a journalistic imperative to show movement or even show exaggeration in people's facial features because you want the reader to be in that moment.
It's almost like editing in a radio or TV piece. You know, you're heightening certain elements.
Heightening, but getting to an essential truth. I mean, not heightening to get away from the truth, actually to get to it.
Mm-hmm. So that's where you set yourself apart from the more sensationalist reporters, for example.
You know, I've always set myself apart from the more sensationalist reporters. Yeah.
Which book of yours was it that Chris Hitchens
introduced? The Introduction to Sefer Yehoshua.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
That's when I still really admired him. He'd sort of not flipped then, really. He flipped, I mean, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it wasn't just politically, but something happened. He became sort of mean-spirited in a way.
He was always mean-spirited. It was always about Hitchens, you know.
I thought he was a really good writer, though.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good writer, and he was smart.
And even... I mean, I would still read him occasionally, even when I didn't absolutely—I just couldn't agree at all with his politics.
Mm-hmm.
But because he's just a good writer. But I sort of disliked him more for being a good writer, using his good writing in this sort of way.
He's provocative. That's one of the things.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's a good thing to put on your tombstone. He's provocative.
Well, the book is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Once again, I'd like to thank our guests today. Chris Hedges spent some 15 years traveling the world as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times before becoming senior fellow at the Nation Institute. His books include Death of the Liberal Class, American Fascists, and War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Joe Sacco has spent nearly 20 years touring war zones and trouble spots and drawing the personal stories of the people he meets there. Some of his best-known titles are War's End, Palestine, and Footnotes in Gaza. Chris and Joe, best of luck with the book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Let's all look forward to better days ahead.
Yeah, let's hope. Thank you.
And I'm your host, S.W. Konser. Thanks for tuning in to Words and Pictures on KBOO Radio.
You've been listening to a special archived episode of Words and Pictures that until today has only been available on KBOO's website. Host S.W. Konser spoke with Nation Institute Senior Fellow Chris Hedges and comics journalist Joe Sacco back in June of 2012 live in the KBOO studios about their book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Thanks for listening and be sure to visit the KBOO website for other archived shows. Today's episode can be found at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Raven's Flight Creative, presenting an evening with author, comedian, inventor, and mustache enthusiast John Hodgman from The Daily Show. John Hodgman speaks at the Baghdad Theater Thursday, March 7th at 7 p.m. The Baghdad Theater is at 3702 Southeast Hawthorne, and accompanied minors are welcome. Tickets at cascadetickets.com. Thank you.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503-232-HOPS. Shocks of Sheba has also been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.
Do